In our last lecture, we used Aristotle's syllogisms to emphasize the central concept of validity. We need to know when the logic of an argument is solid, a genuinely logical transition from premises to conclusion. Visualizing syllogisms in terms of three circle Venn diagrams gave us a picture of validity in the strongest Aristotelian sense, airtight, ironclad validity. Now it's time to go beyond Aristotle. His is a wonderful little logic, but it's a little logic. The structure of human reasoning goes much farther. Structure is the key to logic, just as Aristotle said. But we need to look at the structure of argument much more broadly than he did. We also need to look at validity much more broadly. We emphasize that Aristotle's validity is validity in the highest degree. It's what we now call deductive validity. Given the truth of the premises, an argument is deductively valid if the conclusion absolutely has to be true. Given the truth of the premises, it's impossible for the conclusion to be false. Ironclad, airtight validity is great when you can get it. But it's actually pretty rare outside of the realm of pure mathematics or perfect little syllogisms. If we restricted our reasoning to cases in which arguments had to be absolutely ironclad, our reasoning wouldn't get us very far. The full concept of validity is wider than that. In general, validity refers to the degree of support between premises and conclusion. All kinds of support, of all different degrees. Does this fact support this claim? Do these premises render the conclusion highly plausible? Does this evidence give us good reason to believe the conclusion? The reasoning may not be airtight, but is it solid enough to act upon? Here, we'll emphasize validity in this wider sense, as a matter of logical support between premises and conclusion, even if not ironclad. Here's an example of the kind of argument we have to deal with every day. You'll notice that it's far more complicated than a syllogism. Spending $50 billion in annual economic aid to foreign countries would be justified only if we knew that either they would genuinely benefit from the exchange or that we would. We don't know that we would benefit from the exchange. It might further weaken our already vulnerable economy. We don't know that they would genuinely benefit. The track record of foreign aid that's been misdirected, misappropriated, or lost in foreign corruption is all too familiar. With $50 billion a year, we could offer college scholarships to every high school graduate and major health benefits for every man, woman, and child in the United States. Our obligations are first and foremost to our fellow citizens. We should spend that $50 billion here rather than in foreign aid. There are lots of premises in that argument, far more than in Aristotle's syllogisms, lots of transition steps. Together, they're intended to drive us toward the conclusion. But how good is the argument? And how should we analyze an argument like that? Trying to decompose it into syllogism seems a little crazy. Is there some other tool we can use to analyze more complex arguments? Yes, a very simple visualization. It doesn't give us an automatic answer like Venn diagrams did. We've left the comfy realm of automatic answers behind. But engaging the validity of an argument, we still have to look systematically at logical flow. And a great tool for that is a flow diagram. The idea is to use a flow diagram to sketch the train of thought. That'll let us see how the premises are intended to support the conclusion. We can then look at how strong those lines of support really are. A flow graph of the argument will help us see how valid it is. As in the case of syllogisms, of course, even a solidly valid argument isn't enough to guarantee truth. Validity doesn't address the truth of the premises, for example. But it can tell us whether the truth of those premises would be enough to assure us of the conclusion, or whether we wouldn't be justified in believing the conclusion even if the premises were true. Breaks, disconnects, and weak logical links can show us invalidity in an argument. So, how to analyze complex arguments? Let's give flow diagrams a try. The basic rule is simple. When one claim is intended to support another, we put an arrow from the first to the second. That sounds pretty simple, but it can be tricky. Here's one problem. Let me give you a proposition. You tell me whether we should enter it as a premise or a conclusion. Gladys's marriage is on the rocks. Is that a premise or a conclusion? The answer is that it might be either. In one context, it might appear as a premise. In another context, it might appear as a conclusion. It all depends on the context of argument. Here, for example, it appears in the conclusion. Gladys is no longer interested in Bill. Bill seems to find no time for Gladys. Gladys's marriage is on the rocks. But the same proposition might appear as a premise in a different argument, like this one. Gladys's marriage is on the rocks. Her sister Ethel has mounting gambling debts. Their mother is in the hospital. The whole family is having trouble. There, Gladys's marriage comes in as just one premise toward a different conclusion, that the whole family is having trouble. Propositions don't come labeled as premises or conclusions. They can function in either role. It all depends on the context, on the structure of the argument. Here's another difficulty. The first sentence you hear doesn't always come first logically. Consider this little argument, for example. If the governor is impeached, we might be no better off. Impeaching him would require another election. But there's always the chance that people would then vote for someone equally corrupt. We could number the propositions in the order of presentation. But what we want to know is something different. We want to know where the reasoning flows from and where it flows to. It'll help if we can identify the conclusion. Which is the conclusion, the first, second, or third sentence? One, if the governor is impeached, we might be no better off. Two, impeachment would require another election. Three, we would therefore have the possibility that people would vote for someone equally corrupt. It's the first, proposition one, that's the conclusion, right there at the beginning. Everything else is offered in support of that conclusion. The logic of the argument starts from two, impeachment would require another election. That leads to three, we would therefore have the possibility that people would vote for someone equally corrupt. And that leads to the conclusion. If the governor is impeached, we might be no better off. Draw it in a flow diagram, and you have an arrow from 2 to 3, and another from there to 1. Arrows for logical flow. Simple argument, simple flow diagram. Of course, arguments get more complicated than that. We'll need to add complications in the flow diagrams. First of all, arrows can branch. A set of propositions can lead to multiple conclusions, parallel conclusions. Listen to this argument and think about how you'd graph it. We can only get so much money from taxes. Taxation resources have to be balanced across different social needs. Taxation for prisons must therefore be balanced against taxation for education. If we build more prisons, we'll have less for education. If we spend more on education, we'll have less for the prisons we may need. Number those 1 through 4. And figure out what the argument flow diagram will look like. Press pause if you want, and then come back. That argument has branching conclusions. The first proposition leads directly to the second. From one, we can only get so much money from taxes, taxation resources have to be balanced across different social needs. We graph an arrow to two. Taxation for prisons must therefore be balanced against taxation for education. But at that point, our arrows branch. If taxation for prisons must be balanced against taxation for education, it follows that three, if we build more prisons, we'll have less for education. If taxation for each has to be balanced against the other, it also follows that four, if we spend more on education, we'll have less for the prisons we may need. Notice that I haven't said anything about the truth of those premises. Here, as in Aristotle, we're just examining the flow of the argument. We want to trace the intended train of thought, a logical line that is supposed to step us from one proposition to another to the conclusion, or as in this case, to multiple conclusions. Here's a second complication in argument flow diagrams. Just as arrows can branch out, they can branch in. Sometimes several propositions lead to the same place. We'll start with a simple case in which there are a set of different premises that lead independently to the same conclusion. Independent reasons are reasons that don't need each other. They are each little arguments in their own right. So here's an example. We are dangerously reliant on foreign energy sources. Our oil comes primarily from the Middle East. Most of our natural gas does as well. Even the elements in our batteries come from places like Zambia, Nairobi, and China. In order to analyze the argument, start by numbering the propositions. Then draw a flow diagram of how the logic is supposed to go. First, find the conclusion. It's not the last sentence. This isn't an argument about batteries. It's an argument for a general conclusion about our reliance on foreign energy sources. The conclusion is the first sentence. Each of the other propositions is a little argument for that conclusion in its own right. In an advertising layout, this is called bullet type. You're given three independent reasons to buy a Hyundai, for example. It gets good gas mileage. It looks great. It comes with an extended warranty. All independent reasons. The reasons in this argument work the same way. Our oil comes primarily from the Middle East. Conclusion: we are dangerously reliant on foreign energy sources. Our natural gas does too. Conclusion: we are dangerously reliant on foreign energy sources. Even the elements in our batteries come from places like Zambia, Nairobi, and China. Conclusion: we are dangerously reliant on foreign energy sources. Three independent lines of support. We graph it by having little arrows converge on a single conclusion. Independent reasons function independently. But sometimes reasons have to function together in order to lead to a conclusion. Dependent reasons only function together. Here's what an argument based on dependent reasons looks like. If both partners are indifferent, any marriage is guaranteed to fail. Gladys no longer cares about the relationship. Her husband Bill is far too busy with work to think about his relationship with Gladys. This marriage is doomed. The context indicates that Gladys and Bill are married. We can number the first proposition 1. If both partners are indifferent, any marriage is guaranteed to fail. Note that it says both partners. Along with 1, we therefore need both 2, that Gladys is indifferent, and 3, that Bill is indifferent, in order to get our conclusion. Here, all three propositions work together. Those are dependent reasons. In order to mark them as a set that has to work together, I graph them with a plus between them, a bar under all 3, and a single arrow from there to the conclusion. So how do you know whether propositions are working independently toward a conclusion or working dependently? Argument stress testing. Stress testing in a machine or an organization involves asking what'll happen if a certain component fails. We do the same thing here. If you have independent reasons and one of them fails, the argument should still go through. Let's stress test our example about energy reliance. 1, we are dangerously reliant on foreign energy sources. 2, our oil comes primarily from the Middle East. 3, most of our natural gas does as well. 4, even the elements in our batteries come from places like Zambia, Nairobi, and China. Put it through a stress test. The conclusion is 1. 2, 3, and 4 are given in support. But what if 3 turns out to be false? Excuse me, Mr. Speaker, but the fact is that most of our natural gas does not come from the Middle East. Is Mr. Speaker lunched? Is the argument over? No. He may be a bit embarrassed, but the argument is still standing. Well, all right. But be that as it may, it is still true that we are dangerously reliant on foreign energy. Our oil comes primarily from the Middle East. We use batteries for energy, but even the elements in our batteries come from places like Zambia, Nairobi, and China. You can test each of the other premises the same way. If you knock out a reason and the argument is still standing, it must be because that was an independent reason. That won't hold for dependent reasons. Consider the second example. If both partners are indifferent, any marriage is guaranteed to fail. Gladys no longer cares about the relationship. Her husband Bill is far too busy with work to think about his relationship with Gladys. This marriage is doomed. Excuse me, Mr. Speaker, but you're wrong about Gladys. She still cares deeply about the relationship. Unless he changes one of the other claims, the argument is now dead in the water. The basic premise was that if both partners are indifferent, a marriage is guaranteed to fail. His conclusion was that this marriage is therefore doomed. But if he's wrong about Gladys, the other parts aren't enough to give him that conclusion. That's the sign of propositions functioning dependently. You now have the basic elements of any argument flow graph. But when you start to graph real arguments, you see how those elements can combine into an immense variety of structures. Take the argument we started with, for example. We'll number the propositions in order. 1. Spending $50 billion in annual economic aid to foreign countries would be justified only if we knew that either they would genuinely benefit from the exchange or that we would. 2. We don't know that we would benefit from the exchange. 3. It might further weaken our already vulnerable economy. 4. We don't know that they would genuinely benefit. 5. We're all too familiar with the fact that our foreign aid has very often been misdirected, misappropriated, or lost in foreign corruption. 6. With $50 billion a year, we could offer college scholarships to every high school graduate and major health benefits for every man, woman, and child in the United States. 7. Our obligations are first and foremost to our fellow citizens. 8. We should spend that $50 billion here rather than in foreign aid. The conclusion is 8. How are the rest of the propositions meant to support that conclusion? Press pause and make a graph of how you think this argument is supposed to flow. Take a few minutes. This is a pretty complicated argument. Then come back. Here's my sketch of that argument. The argument uses two dependent clusters functioning independently of each other. One cluster uses 1, 2, and 4. Spending $50 billion in economic aid to foreign countries would be justified only if we knew either A or B. We don't know A. We don't know B. So spending the money that way isn't justified. Those work together. That's why I represent them with a plus between them and a bar beneath them. Together, they offer a little independent argument. If a stress test showed that the stuff about the college education in 6 and 7 was false, 1, 2, and 4 together would still stand as an independent argument for the conclusion. Where do 3 and 5 appear in that argument? They're really little backups for 2 and 4. 2 says we don't know that we would benefit from the exchange. Why? Because 3, it might further weaken our economy. 4 says that we don't know that they would benefit. Why? Because 5, foreign aid has so often gone astray. All of those together make one argument for the conclusion. There's another argument in there that comes from 6 and 7 working together. With that money, we could offer college scholarships to every high school graduate and major health benefits for every man, woman, and child in the United States. And our obligations are first and foremost to our fellow citizens. those together offer their own little argument for spending the money here rather than in foreign aid. As real arguments go, even that one is fairly simple. Here's the real challenge. Clip out a newspaper editorial. Take just one or two paragraphs and graph out the argument. If you do that, you'll discover a number of things. Just as we said, the conclusion doesn't always come last. Sometimes it takes real work to figure out what the conclusion is supposed to be. You'll also find that the flow of reasons can be very complex. Often two claims support a third, which is a subconclusion. It's like a subtotal. It's an intermediate conclusion, just part of the way toward a final conclusion. You'll find some claims in an editorial that are very important. Some will be minor. Some will be widely accepted. Some will be accepted only in very specific belief structures. The most important thing you'll notice is how much goes unsaid in normal arguments. What goes unsaid is often the most important part. An argument is often most vulnerable at the points at which major assumptions are made, but are not made explicit. With an understanding of the flow of argument, we have the tools for looking at validity and vulnerability, argumentative strengths and weaknesses. How valid is the argument? That means, how strong is the logical flow from premises to conclusion? If the premises are true, is the conclusion extremely plausible, highly probable, downright inescapable? If the answer to any of these is yes, we have a valid argument. This is still an internal evaluation of logical strength. It doesn't tell us whether the premises are in fact true. If they are true, we have something even better, a sound argument. A sound argument is one that's both valid and does have true premises. Because they're true and because the reasoning is valid, we have solid reasons to believe the conclusion is true, too. I'm going to expand a little on flow graphs for arguments using the work of the philosopher Stephen Tolman. We've talked about premises that function together, representing them as little numbers with a plus between them. What Tolman points out is that there is often more structure just beneath that plus. Some of those little numbers may stand for premises that function as what he calls data. Some function instead as what he calls warrants. They function together, just like we've said, but function together in a specific way. Here's what I mean. Any argument starts with some kind of data. But an argument often doesn't just go from data to conclusion. It has a middle step. A step that says how that data is supposed to lead to the conclusion. So instead of just a plus between premises 1 and 2, it might be better to represent them like this. Here's an example. The CAT scan shows a shadow on the lungs. When there's that kind of shadow, cancer is a real possibility, and so further tests are in order. We should do a biopsy. The data in this case? The fact that the CAT scan shows a shadow on the lungs. The conclusion? That we should do a biopsy. The warrant is the general principle that takes us from the data to the conclusion. It's not so much an additional piece of information as an inference ticket. Given this data, we should draw this conclusion. In this case, the warrant is, when there's that kind of shadow, cancer is a real possibility, and so further tests are in order. Here's another example. You tell me what the conclusion is, what's playing the role of data, and what's acting as warrant. He can't be guilty of first-degree murder. The defendant was heavily intoxicated at the time and acted in the heat of emotion. First-degree murder demands premeditation. Press pause and think about it for a minute if you want to. The data? The claim that the defendant was intoxicated at the time and acted in the heat of emotion. The conclusion that he can't be guilty of first-degree murder. What's the warrant? What greases the track from data to conclusion? The principle that first-degree murder demands premeditation. Data, emotion, and intoxication at the time. Warrant, First degree demands premeditation. Conclusion, he can't be guilty of first degree murder. There are, of course, very different kinds of arguments. Scientific arguments, legal arguments, ethical arguments. It's important to note that very different kinds of warrants are appropriate for those different kinds of arguments. For some arguments, in scientific contexts, for example, it's a probability warrant that's appropriate. 90% of the experiments showed a latency effect. That's strong inductive or empirical support. Sometimes the argument's over the use of a term. In that case, the warrant may be a definition. Whales breathe air and give live birth, so they're mammals. Sometimes it's a legal principle that serves as warrant. The contract wasn't signed, it's therefore unenforceable. The warrant? A legal principle that unsigned contracts aren't enforceable. Sometimes it's an ethical rule that serves as warrant. It was deliberately deceitful, so what he did was wrong. Here, the warrant is our belief that deception is unethical. Graphing arguments in terms of data and warrant can help in analyzing both individual arguments and the structure of debates. We all know that there are often two sides to an issue. The distinction between data and warrant lets us see that there are two different ways those different sides may be in conflict. Sometimes what's at issue in a controversy is disagreement about the data. Any argument will go from data to conclusion. If one side doesn't recognize the other side's starting point as genuine data, there's going to be no meeting of the minds. That's a problem in disputes regarding abortion. Opponents of legalized abortion may start the argument with, "A fetus is a person." Precisely because that claim is not accepted as genuine data by the opposition, the argument won't convince the other side. Proponents of legalized abortion, on the other hand, may start the argument with, "A woman's rights regarding her own body are absolute." Precisely because that is not accepted as data on the other side, their argument fails to convince the other side as well. But controversies often continue even when both sides do agree on the data. Why? Because the two sides don't agree on what the data warrants. Controversies regarding gun control seem to be like this. The statistics on gun ownership, crime, and accidents in the home may be conceded on both sides. Both sides may agree that there is a right to self-defense. They may even agree on what the Second Amendment says. But one side thinks that the statistics warrant restrictions on gun ownership despite individual rights. The other side thinks that individual rights trump the social statistics, that the statistics alone are insufficient warrant for further restriction. When you graph that controversy in terms of data and warrant, it's clear that the core dispute is over the prioritization of values. Individual rights versus the prevention of harm. The two sides may agree on the data, but emphasis on different background principles takes them from that same data to different conclusions. In that case, you have a dispute over warrant. The next time you find yourself in apparent controversy with someone, ask whether you disagree about the data or the warrant. That may help to keep people from talking past each other. Graphing logical flow can only take you so far, of course. It can't alone resolve disputes like this, but it can help in deciding where the dispute really lies. Here's what I want you to take home from this lecture. Rational argument is a matter of logical flow. To understand an argument is to be able to see that logical flow, to see lines of argument that branch to multiple conclusions, to see how different reasons may work independently to support a conclusion, or to see how they may have to work dependently together. If we can sketch out the logical flow, we have a better grasp on validity, on how strong the reasons offered really are for the conclusion. We can also identify stress points of vulnerability. Analysis in terms of data and warrant offers a further fine-tuning of the graphing approach, particularly useful in analyzing what's really in dispute in long-standing controversies. In the next lecture, we'll move to aspects of our reasoning that don't need graphing. Aspects of reasoning that are quick and dirty, but often very effective. We'll be talking about conceptual heuristics that make us smart.